Good evening, it's Friday night at 7 o'clock and you're listening to another edition of Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a show about ideas. Those ideas might or might not have something to do with rationalism, science or the Enlightenment. Our guest on tonight's show is the author Mary Roach. Mary Roach has written for The Guardian, GQ, Salon, Wired, Vogue and the New York Times magazine. She is the author of Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, and 6 Feet Over, Adventures in the Afterlife. Her latest book is called Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Sex and Science. I spoke to Mary earlier this week about the book, and we talked about sex. If you've ever wondered how to stimulate a pig to orgasm, then please stay tuned. Mary, thanks for agreeing to talk to Little Atoms today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I came across your new book. I'd missed it sort of being released, and I saw it in a bookshop the other day, and my first thought was, fantastic, Mary's got a new book out, we're going to have to get her on the show. And then I picked it up and sort of read the blurb on the back and got it home and started reading it and thought, I'm actually going to have to talk about this. This is going to be quite difficult.
Yes. Now you know how I feel.
Well, that's it. That's what I want you to talk about. There's a couple of, in the introduction, you talk about some of the difficulties of writing a book on the subject matter of sex and the difficulties of researching it. So let's talk about that. Tell us about how did you find setting out to write this book different from your previous books?
Well, I guess that doing a book about cadavers was good training for me because, when I wrote Stiff, it was a couple of years of people saying, oh, you're writing a book? That's fantastic. What's it about? And I'd say, cadavers and strange things people have done with them. And that's a real showstopper right there. And people seriously began to think that I was a little nuts because they couldn't imagine what the book was. So, cadavers, that's really kind of strange and upsetting. So, by the time I got around to writing about sex, it was nothing. It was no big deal because I'd already done the cadaver book. But it's interesting, though, because, when I wrote about cadavers, I people would say, oh, Mary's a little obsessed with death.
Yeah.
And then, so I thought, okay, great, that now people will think I'm obsessed with sex, and that's a lot more normal.
Well, did also, of course, write 6 Feet Over, which was another book about death, so...
Well, it's more about paranormal research trying to prove there's an afterlife, but essentially, yeah, it is related to death. So I was getting a bit of a heavy reputation.
Was writing about sex somehow life-affirming then?
It was life-affirming and much more. It just is a lot more, it feels a lot more normal to be writing about sex than to be writing about cadavers and dying people. So even though it's a little awkward always to be talking to strangers constantly about sex, but you get used to it so fast. I mean, after 6 months of interviewing people, I say words like masturbation, clitoris, vagina, orgasm. It's like talking about tires for me. So really the words, all of the electricity that's attached to those words sort of went away, and I became this person walking around just talking about sex to total strangers and thinking nothing of it, which is how everybody should be ultimately, I think.
This is true, but I unfortunately haven't had the luxury of the 6 months. Please excuse me if I do end up euphemizing things a little bit.
I understand.
So how did the idea for the book come about then? I mean, you've often written before on books have come from sort of magazine articles or something that you've been commissioned. So how did this one?
Yeah, this one came from, I remember the moment specifically, I was reading a back issue of Film Quarterly, and I don't really remember why. I don't subscribe to Film Quarterly. I'm not a real film buff, but anyway, regardless, I read this reference to the films that Masters and Johnson made in the 60s, and they were not your average films. These were actually made using a penis camera, and they were documenting female sexual arousal from the inside of a woman's body as she was responding to this phallus, which had a camera in it. And I thought, I just remember thinking, whoa, sex research, next book. That's the next book right there. I'd heard of Masters and Johnson, and I knew that they were some people who researched sex, but I had no idea how they'd gone about it, and I never really thought about, the particular challenges of studying something that is very intimate and personal, studying it in a laboratory, how do you do that? Got to be kind of awkward. So that was really the moment I decided to do the book.
Well, there's also what you talk about in that same sort of way that the study of sex was seen as somehow suspicious and somehow sort of subversive as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, certainly, yeah. That was particularly up through, I would say it wasn't really until the 70s that it became something somebody could confess to doing without getting a lot of raised eyebrows and possibly career demerits. You know, it was something that, you know, you people would do, they couldn't get subjects. You know, the early researchers, John Watson, I almost said James Watson, John Watson, who's a behaviorist, the psychologist who came up with behaviorism. In the 30s, he was really the first in the U.S. to bring subjects into a laboratory to study sex. He felt like that this was something that deserved to be studied in a scientific manner, but he didn't know how to go about it. He actually ended up studying himself and a student of his that he happened to be having an affair
what they called
with.
It. That's a euphemism there, right there.
Yeah. So it was a very awkward thing for people, and it still is. Cindy Meston, the researcher that I spoke to here in the States, I said, "What do you, you know, you sit next to someone on a plane and they say, oh, and what do you do for a living?" She said, "I lie, or I say I'm involved with autonomic responses to visual stimuli and other, you know," she just sort of cloud it in scientific terms because she said, I don't want to have the conversation that invariably results, which is, oh, you must be really into sex, or, you know, or just the raised eyebrows and the, I bet she's really good, you know, that kind of reaction that people still get today. And even, I'm sure people are talking behind my back, which is fine. I'm used to that.
Well, that's it. People do suspect a sort of unhealthy, you've already raised the idea of an obsession, but...
Yeah. I think there's even, you know, somebody says, well, what are you working on? You know, well, I have this project where I bring, you know, young women into a laboratory and I have them watch segments of pornographic images while I have an instrument in their vagina. People are going to say, oh, yeah, research. It's impossible to describe it without sounding like a pervert.
So, okay, well, let's talk about Masters and Johnson a little bit then. You talk about Kinsey, who's obviously the other famous, sort of researcher, but I particularly want to talk about Masters and Johnson because the penis camera is quite... fascinating.
Yeah, they were Masters and Johnson. Well, did you have a specific question, or
well, just tell us a little about them?
Sure. Yeah. Well, they were really the first to document the entire human sexual response cycle, which is, you know, arousal and orgasm, arousal all the way through orgasm, and they documented it very, very in great detail. When we're talking about, the earlobes will swell at a certain point, and you know they looked at the entire body. You know, there'll be a flush on the chest at a certain point. I mean, they filmed, they took notes, they had almost 700 people come into the lab, sometimes in couples and sometimes just on their own, and in order to really get the nitty gritty, they had to build this device. They called it the artificial coition machine. This is the penis case. And it's very similar to, if you go on the internet and you type in sex machines, you know, you'll find these sort of basement projects that people have built, which is, you know, they'll take a part of some sort of a household appliance, and they'll put a sort of large phallus on the end of it. Well, it wasn't all that far off, except that it had a light source and a film. A small camera, so that they were the first to figure out how vaginal lubrication, for example, worked. And they looked at, you know, when a woman has an orgasm, what is the cervix doing? Is it coming down and sucking up the semen? What is going on in there? And that, to me, was extraordinary. But I was also very intrigued with, you know, the whole notion of women. Like, I really wanted to interview some of these subjects because, to me, I can't even imagine how you could convince somebody to come into your laboratory and get undressed and have sex with, not just have sex, but have good sex, good enough that you're going to have an orgasm, like with this machine. You know, who were these women? And unfortunately, the Masters and Johnson are very protective of well, unfortunately for me, I should say, they're very protective of the privacy of their subjects. So I wasn't able to interview any of these extraordinary individuals. But they do say toward the end of the book that they specifically searched for people who were easily orgasmic and who were relatively confident that this would be a successful sexual experience for them.
And yeah, and in some way that they were sort of criticized for that, because that sort of skewed the skewed the results a bit.
Right, you're not talking about, you know, Jane Average there. This is not your average American woman, I don't believe, particularly for 1962 or whenever they you know, the book came out in 66, but the project had gone on and all through the early 60s.
Well, you just mentioned in discussing that the sort of there was throwaway remark about people making cannibalizing vacuum cleaners and things and making making sex machines in their shed. You did actually meet some of these people. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I did. It was coincidentally there was an event at the Center for Sex and Culture here in San Francisco that a photographer. He's actually a very respected art photographer who did a bunch of portraits of people with their sex machines. So it's a fantastic book, by the way. I think it's just called Sex Machines. But and it's a very, you know, they're never seen. They're not shown having sex with their machines. They're standing there, kind of like a 4-H club guy with his cow, you know. 4-H is a, you know, farmers group here.
Sure.
And anyway, he was doing a talk, and many of the inventors were going to be there with their machines, and I thought, and people were invited to try the machines out, and I thought, okay, now maybe I'll be able to get an answer to who are these women climbing onto these sort of basically piston-driven dildos. And reliably getting off on it. And so I went to the event, and only one person actually took part. It was a book talk, and everybody, and then people walked around with their cups of wine and looked at the machines. It was sort of looked like an art opening. But then as time went on, it got toward 11 o'clock, a couple people decided to try them out. And so but interestingly, the woman who tried out, it was called a Thrill Hammer, and the largest of the machines that was on hand there, quite intimidating. And he handed her a Hitachi wand, which is a vibrator. He said, oh, I give everybody one of these who buy, you know, anybody who would buy one of these machines or commission. I guess they're not really for commercial sale. So anyway, the women were not, in fact, having orgasms just from having sex with the machines. They required the help of the Hitachi wand.
So he could just as well have been selling a sofa, really.
Exactly, and giving them a vibrator with each sofa, exactly.
That's probably a good marketing campaign for furniture warehouses.
I think it is. I think you'd see a dramatic rise in sales.
So, okay, let's talk about part of the research into, you know, human sexuality is obviously in the past and to the present has been done on animals. Mm-hmm. And there's some lovely vignettes in the book about people fingering monkeys and things, and but there's a really great chapter where you go to Denmark and visit a pig fertilization factory. So tell us a little about that.
Sure. Yeah, that's a chapter about what's called upsuck. Upsuck is this notion that when a woman has an orgasm, the contractions, the muscular contractions, suck up the semen and deliver the sperm to the egg really quickly.
And that might somehow be helpful to fertilization.
Yeah, it might boost the odds of conception, and you'd get, you know, be more easily fertilized if you were regularly having orgasms. So, and there was a great deal of, this was something that was absolutely believed in the 16th, 17th, even the 1800s, that there was that in order to get pregnant, you had to have an orgasm as a woman, which was lovely for women back in the, there was a wonderful, in the Habsburg Empire, there was a quote from Empress Maria Theresa, who's the court physician, told her, because she was having trouble conceiving, he said, I'm of the opinion that the vulva of your most sacred majesty be titillated for some time before intercourse. I mean, wouldn't that be nice if you went to the doctor?
You couldn't say that to the queen. You couldn't say that to our queen, I don't think.
Maybe they should. But anyway, yeah, wouldn't it be nice if a visit to the doctor resulted with that kind of advice, rather. you know, prescription for Prozac. But anyway, so Upsuck, the debate continued all the way. Masters and Johnson did some work, actually, but I can get back to that. But the pigs, okay, the pigs. You did ask me about the
pigs.
Yeah,
let's talk about the pigs.
The pigs, yeah, okay. In Denmark, their artificial inseminators will, as they're inseminating a sow, they will sexually stimulate her and do some of the things that the boar would do prior to mating. They do this because they found that when they do, then they have a 6% higher farrowing rate, meaning the number of piglets that are produced over a year. So in other words, if the female is having a good time, she's going to have a lot, she's going to have more piglets. So that there's this amazing 5-point sow stimulation plan that the artificial inseminators do. I had this video. I actually went to Denmark. Because that's the kind of idiot I am. I will go all the way to Denmark to watch somebody sexually stimulate a sow, and I tell you, it was worth it. But they the boar has a different courtship strategy than the human male. The snout is
than some boring. Human males.
Than what?
Than some
than
human
some.
Males.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Then I should have qualified that. The snout is used a lot. They don't have hands, but the pigs are, as far as I know, the only other species where breast manipulation is part of foreplay. But the boar will use his snout because, you know, lacking hands, uses his snout. So the inseminators will sometimes do that. There's a whole series of steps that they go through. But anyway, there's this wonderful shot in the video where they show it's this, you know, handsome tan blonde Dane guy in a white lab coat, and he's lying on the back of this female pig, reaching down, you know, and sort of massaging her teats. But before this begins, there's sort of a close-up on his left hand and you know, showing his wedding ring as though to reassure you that, you know, nothing unseemly is going
it's
to happen with these two.
Not yeah, an improper exactly. relationship with the
pig. Yeah, exactly. But it was interesting, you know, talking to some of the, you know, I'd say, you know, I was trying to, it's a little awkward, you know, young men who, you know, it's just their job, and here's this person with a notepad watching them and wanting to know, you know, does it ever feel weird to do this?
That is quite, you do paint that quite well, though, because clearly it is, they're all quite uncomfortable with the idea of it. I mean, it not in any way joking apart in any way, is it in any way sort of titillating? You know, the guys are all like quite sort of, you know, clearly quite perturbed by what they're doing, aren't they? It's quite interesting.
Yeah, one of them said it is what it is. It's just you know, it produces more bacon, essentially. You know, I remember saying to this woman who's one of the researchers who'd come up with, you know, the Danish pork production board came up with a stimulation plan, and I was looking at the pig and saying, wow, I can't really tell that she's having an orgasm. And, you know, and it was so funny. The woman said, well, you know, me personally, I would love it if she was, but ultimately, you know, it's what we're concerned with here is pork.
Okay, well, you just mentioned there about the queen. I can't remember the name of the queen that you mentioned.
And Maria Theresa.
Yeah, and the enlightened attitudes of the court physicians in those days. But they also had some rather bonkers ideas, and I'm sort of raising that because I want to bring us on to the subjects of impotence and correlate to that, masturbation as well. Well, just tell us about some of the sort of 17th, 18th century ideas on this, and particularly I'd like to talk about this, the French impotence courts, which are quite strange. I've never come across before.
No, in the 1600s, 1700s, it was illegal to not perform the sex was basically a rite that was performed within. I mean, it was legally, you had to be having intercourse, essentially. And if you were impotent, if you weren't fulfilling your obligations, it was grounds for divorce, because marriage was a sacrament, And so if you were violating the sacrament by not being able to have intercourse, then you would have to, the wife would divorce you and you'd have to return the dowry or the money. So part of the court proceedings was that the man would have to perform in front of these legal entities. They were impotence trials. So there'd be a couple, and they'd be in a room, and outside the door would be, people with their clipboards and their their notepads. And as soon as the couple, the man was, there were two things. He'd have to prove that he could get it up, that he was not impotent. And then later there was actually another segment of this where he would actually have to prove that he had a hard enough erection to have intercourse. And the woman would be sometimes trying to prevent this because it was to her benefit to prove that he couldn't. So, he would be trying to reach down and sort of dilate her with his fingers. She'd be trying to block him from and this was all part of the court proceedings. And there's these amazing, descriptions of these legal, court cases where there's five or six people looking around and, inspecting the man's erection and commenting on it. And then, later on, witnessing the act in order to make sure that the man, in fact, could do what he said he could do, and just astounding.
You also mentioned the idea that that impotence could be brought on by witches and curses.
The thinking about impotence over the centuries is kind of is bizarre and fascinating. It was for a long time thought to be a psychological problem, but even before then, it was thought that it was brought on by a curse, a witch's curse, and that the man was demons that were sort of possessing him and trying to so there'd be these wonderful. There actually was this whole book of how to undo the curses that have been put upon you, and there's but you got the sense that there was some inkling that this was largely psychological and psychosomatic, because they'd say, well, try to think about who might have put this curse on you and go and have a talk with her. And then there was the last line of defense was, if this doesn't work, try violence. I love that. If this doesn't work, try some violence.
But there's also this idea that was about the time that people would think somehow, and it's difficult to know whether it was psychological or they really thought this, that their penises had been sort of stolen
There was this wonderful passage talking about how, and if this, and some people say that this isn't real, the witches aren't actually stealing the man's penis. But if this were the case, then how would we explain these boxes with 10 or 20 penises all moving around and eating oats and barley? I mean, it was this bizarre. This is absolutely bizarre. This is Malleus Maleficarum. It's this ancient tome on how to deal with witchcraft and curses, and these discussions going back and forth about whether or not the penis was actually missing or whether the man just sort of thought that the penis was missing. And there were some there was a priest who was saying, well, at a certain point I had the young man disrobe so that I could make sure his penis was still there. And I thought, well, that's a good excuse.
All right. Well, finally, we're sort of running out of time. But I want to talk about, you mentioned earlier, one of the genesis of this book was reading about this, the penis machine, and thinking, who on earth would volunteer to go into a laboratory and basically, have sex or something in a big machine in front of people in white coats, and by the end of the book, basically you've found out, haven't you?
I can tell you who those people are, because I am one. Here's what happened. I heard about this guy in London, actually, who was doing he's got this three-dimensional ultrasound imaging technique, which is really quite extraordinary. You've got this three-dimensional moving picture image of, lips puckering or a penis erecting. And, you know, he publishes in The Lancet. I mean, this guy is not some fly-by-night wannabe researcher. He's quite well regarded. Anyway, he made reference to wanting to actually document human genitals in sexual congress using this technique. And of course, I sent him an email, said I'd really like to be there for this historic undertaking. And he wrote back and said, yes, well, see, here's the trouble. We don't actually have any volunteers. So if your organization would like to provide a brave couple, I'd be happy to oblige. Well, so my organization asked its husband, my organization being me, and I actually said to him, you know how you said you hadn't been to Europe in 25 years? How would you like to go to London, say? You know, and I set this whole scene where we'd go to the West End and see some plays and go off maybe to Stonehenge. And by the way, for one afternoon, we'd have to be documented having sex in front of a researcher, but, you know, I'm sure we'd maybe go on. go over to the coast, and so he agreed, fool that he is, and now I have the answer to what it's like to be one of those people, and the answer is that it's extremely strange and awkward, and particularly challenging for the man, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the burden of performance was on him. For me, it was all made palatable by the fact that it would be this really quite entertaining scene in the book. And for Ed, it was really just a moment of, you know, I'm a supportive husband, and I can't believe I've agreed to this, and I'll never do it again, and I hate you.
most supportive husbands, that's just basically driving you to an assignment or something.
Yeah, this is really above and beyond the call of duty.
So did you see the pictures?
Yeah, it's on the internet.
Oh, good heavens.
It's the most G-rated, X-rated imagery you'll ever see. It's because it's ultrasound. It's really kind of grainy, and it's only like a second and a half of footage. So you hit the play button, you're like, that was it. But I mean, he did manage to get the image. It's not in the sort of 3D. It doesn't look as 3D as some of his other images. It didn't work as well as I thought it would. But it's an interesting. I'm kind of, you know, I'm waiting for him to publish the paper because I'm really quite thrilled about being, you know, the couple that did it in ultrasound.
Fantastic. Well, I highly recommend your book, Mary. It's hilariously funny, and I don't know if this is necessarily a recommendation, but it makes you. You're constantly crossing your legs and feeling sick to the stomach at various points, and you'll never look at a toothbrush in the same way again for a start as well. But
yeah, that's for sure. There's actually two toothbrush. I just realized that there's two sexually implicated toothbrushes in the book in separate chapters.
It's published by Canongate in the UK, and I highly recommend it. And Mary, thank you very much for speaking to Little Atoms today.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It was fun. Thank you.